Brunch is back, ladies and gentlemen, and Yelp Guest Manager is here to help the Sunday Funday crowd find your restaurant. Yelp Guest Manager is the no-fee way to fill your tables, so prepare to spend less. But you're also getting a whole lot more. We're plugging your restaurant into the biggest consumer network in the U.S., creating massive awareness with the folks looking to book now. Sign up for Yelp Guest Manager today to get delayed billing for 60 days to start the brunch season off right. Go to restaurants.yelp.com/full comp to grow your restaurant, not your expenses. Terms apply. Now here we go.
Considering the history of mankind, we're in a time period where things are evolving so quickly, and they are changing before our very eyes. I'd love to come back 400 years from now and just see the changes that are here. They're going to be tremendous. I'm so hopeful for mankind. I think we're on the right trajectory.
Welcome to Full Comp, a show offering insight into the hospitality industry, featuring restaurateurs, thought leaders, and innovators. Served up on the house. Are you on track to hit your profitability goals for this year? If you're struggling to hit your numbers, I might be able to help. Here's how I do it. Every year, I offer 5 complimentary growth sessions to restaurant owners looking to scale. In this call, we'll examine your current situation to see what is and isn't working. We'll identify your growth possibilities by the close of the year. We'll uncover the number one thing holding you and your business back. And we'll develop a growth plan that will get your business results. Go to planwithjosh.com to schedule one of the 5 complimentary growth sessions. They're going to go quickly. They always do. Chef David Lawrence has paved the way for anyone with culinary aspirations to follow. He's worked in some of the best restaurants in the world, and he's opened successful restaurants of his own. And David has accomplished all of this with a smile on his face the whole time, avoiding the overwhelm and the melancholy so closely tied to leadership positions within our industry. In our conversation today, we unpack the chef's formula for consistent success. As it turns out, aspiring to live a good life leads to a great life.
Initially, my dad was not a chef. He worked in a factory. He worked for a company called Hoover, the company that made Hoovers and vacuum cleaners. And I just remember early memory of him working there is him playing cricket on the Hoover team and me looking up and seeing him actually bowl and go, oh my God, my dad's quite an athlete. I always thought I was the athlete in the family. But then to realize my dad was an athlete as well was an amazing feat to see, behold, I should say. But then later on, when I had decided I wanted to be a chef at the age of 13, because in England, you basically have to come back at 14, and your classes are geared to where you're going to go. If you're going to go to university, there's certain classes you have to take. You're going to go to a vocational school, there's certain classes you have to take. I wanted to be a chef. My inspiration was The Galloping Gourmet, Graham Kerr, and then at that point, my dad decided to get into the restaurant business, and he became a very good grill chef at a steakhouse in a place called Eastcote, which is a very posh neighborhood of London, West London, that was very far from where we lived. And so I used to go up there and see him cook. I'd go and wash some dishes and stuff like that. It reinforced what I wanted to do.
What traits did you internalize from your father, watching him cook, working alongside him?
Showing up. Number one, show up, be there every single day. The other thing he was really good at is that customer service. People loved him. No matter where he was, people just loved him. They all came up to him. And my dad was called Frank. And they'd go, Frankie, how are you? And they'd come in and go, I'm doing good. And especially the wives. And the husbands loved the fact that the wives loved the chef. It just made everything easier for them when he walked in. You know how it is. If the wife is happy, everybody's happy. And so my dad had a little sparkle in his smile as well. He was a good-looking guy. He just had great customer presence. Of course, he could cook a mean steak every single time. And he could run a restaurant on his own and was very good at it. Very, very good. And so there was no steaks coming back with him. And his time and his technique and what he did and just how he handled the kitchen basically on his own. And he was very, very calm. I never saw him lose it. He was a very calm chef in that environment. And he liked working on his own. He was one of those grill chefs who worked on his own and ran a restaurant. He would cook for like 120 people in the night, no problem, and put out all the dishes.
And how did that inform the trajectory of your career? Did you want to model something similar in those days?
Well, I knew I wanted to be a chef. And I came out of school and immediately worked at his restaurant that he was at. I just remembered him getting me the job there. And he said, I'm getting you a job here because I'm leaving. I can't work with you in the same place. And I'm moving to another restaurant. I went, okay. And he got me the job there, a place called the Village Inn in Stanmore. And I got there. I got really good at it very quickly. And so that told me something. I needed to do more. If I was really good at this at 16, I needed to move on. And I stayed there for about 2-3 months. And then I started making those steps up the ladder, get into better places. So I ended up going up to Piccadilly, and I worked in a place called Quality Inn at the time. And my dad's cousin, who in the West Indian family, you always called everybody your uncle. And so I went to work with him. And I was there having fun and working with him. It was a little better standard, but still, it was a very touristy restaurant. And it was very steak and chips, and it was Apple a la mode, Black Forest Ghetto, very touristy stuff in the middle of Piccadilly. And the most fun I had around there was running around with a Native American guy called Chief. And the stories I could tell you about that would turn this podcast blue. So we're not going to go back. We're not going to talk about that. That's for another night. But just running around and having that. And I remember I was having so much fun. This guy comes up to me as an Egyptian guy who came in, and he said, well, what are you doing? I said, I'm cooking. He said, are you going to school yet? I go, no. And he was the one who told me, oh, you got to go to college. You got to go to college. You got to learn your craft. And he was the one who focused me straight away to go to Westminster College, which I did. And thank God he did. He got me go into Westminster College in Battersea to do my 706, 1 and 2. And while I was there, there was a gentleman called Frank. I don't remember his last name, but he was a German guy my age, and he was going to school. And he kept talking about the Roux brothers and how good the Roux brothers were and this and that. And if you want to be a good chef, you should go to the Roux brothers. Anyway, so I was just thinking about it. I was like, that's the place I want to go to. Anyway, so I had had another job that I had moved to, and they had treated the chef really bad, gotten him fired. And I said, oh, I've had enough here, because he was my mentor at that place and he was no longer there. And so I didn't want to stay any longer. That night after the chef got fired, I wrote a letter to the Roux brothers saying how I wanted to work for them and I wanted to come to the company, heard how good they were. But thinking about it, in my mind, I felt like they must have had millions and millions of people writing to them and telling them how they wanted to work for them. I wanted to stand out. So the next day I just put on a tie and a shirt and a jacket and some slacks, cleaned my shoes and walked in there. And I walked in, I asked for HR, and this French lady comes up to me and I started talking to her. Unbeknownst to me, Albert Roux, who was to be the significant mentor in my life, was standing right next to her. I had no idea who he was. This is before internet. You couldn't look people up and you didn't know who was who. And I start concocting this story about how I had written to her. She hadn't replied to any of my letters. And I was bringing this back myself so that you took notice of this. And I want to work for you. And she said, well, I always reply to your letters, to all letters. And I said, I don't know what happened, but none of my letters have been replied to. And Albert's listening and looking at me while I'm telling the story. She goes, well, what are you doing now? I said, well, I work for this company and this was January. She said, well, we don't normally take apprentices until September. I said, not a problem. Save me a spot. I will be back in September. I want to work for you. You're the best. I only want to work for you guys. And anyway, so Albert tugs at her and she looks at him and they go around the corner and start talking. She said, leave this with me. I'll be in touch with you. This was January. Oh, beginning of February. February 16th, I get a letter. That's a significant day for me, which is my birthday. And it says, you will start March 1st. And so I didn't have to wait till September. And I started March 1st. And that was the beginning of my career and being able to go and work for the Roux brothers. That just opened up all sorts of avenues for me. It allowed me to go and meet chefs from all over the world, work in a French restaurant, worked at La Gamma, Le Pourbeau, which was one star at the time, and eventually moved to the Gavroche, the mecca of great cuisine in England, where I got to work with a gentleman called Marco Pierre White. I worked with Nene. I worked with Albert, his son. There's just chefs, just famous chefs coming in and out of that place. And so you cannot help but immerse yourself in greatness because it's just all around you. And so I never wanted to be mediocre. So I got to be as good as everybody else there, and quickly found myself absorbing all this information, absorbing all this talent, and moving up the ladder, so to speak, and enjoying my time there very much so.
Let's go back to the ladder. This is very interesting because in my mind, it's like an inflection point in your life. The story goes one of two ways, right? It's the way you tell it, or you show up, you make a huge scene, you're embarrassed, they think you're an idiot, you walk out, and you live in a refrigerator box under an overpass. And that's the other trajectory that your life takes. But it was bold action, right? It required courage and bravery and probably to some degree, looking back, a total lack of common sense, right? This is not how things work.
Oh, completely. No common sense, no fear, because what you don't know, you don't fear. For me, I only saw one vision is like, I got to go there. I got to talk to whoever it takes. They need to see me. I am going to be the best thing since sliced bread. You've got to take me. There's no question. Once you see me, you've got to hire me because I'm just, my enthusiasm, I'm just like a puppy. Yeah. So, you know, put me in the right direction. This is what I want to do. I never expected anybody to say no. I always expected them to say yes. So that was my attitude. It was like, I get in front of you, you're going to say yes. And I've always been like that. Once I get in front of somebody, I've never lost a job. Well, I tell a lie, one job. I lost one job, and that was at Stars. You remember Stars in San Francisco?
I do.
I went there for an interview, and Mark Franz was interviewing me, and he had me cooking there. Jeremiah walked by, looked at me, walked on. Anyway, so at the end of the night, he goes, oh, we're not going to hire you. I go, are you kidding me? You're not going to hire me? I was just so infuriated by that. I said, with my training, what I've done and all that. He said, David, you're too good for this place. You're not going to enjoy it. And I was like, okay. No one has never said to me no. It just doesn't happen.
So that's been a through line through your career, right? Bravery, bold action.
Bold action. Even this job I have to this day, they called me up. I went and did an interview. Then I got in front of Bill and a group of people in there. I just walked outside and started talking to them and told them what I was going to do for them. And from what I hear afterwards, is like, that's the guy. Pay him what he wants. Yeah, you have to be bold and you have to believe in yourself. But also you have to follow up with action. You have to produce.
Now, when we flash forward to like 1300 Fillmore, right? You've had all of these experiences along the way that have been super educational. Great food and beverage does not make a successful restaurant, at least by financial standards. And so how did you acquire the business acumen to take that entrepreneurial leap when it was time?
Well, that was another meeting. So the guy who was running for that. Anyway, so Magic Johnson was trying to get that project. And there was a guy called Michael Johnson who was in the Bay Area, and he was a developer as well. So that was in a neighborhood that was part of redevelopment. So they wanted someone, African-American background. They wanted someone of color to be there to do this fine dining restaurant. They were bringing Yoshi's in with the jazz, and then they had Condo over there. So there were certain things that they needed there, and I fit the bill tremendously. And they wanted someone who was somewhat local. So my wife is born and raised in around the Fillmore area. So she was approached about it, and they said, well, your husband's David Lawrence, so would you guys be interested? And I said, very much so. So that was how we got into that. And just running restaurants for other people for so long, you always have food costs you have to maintain. You always have to watch the bottom line or else you're out of a job. So you're continuously training to be entrepreneurial, although it's not your business. But if you're not, if you don't have that mentality, you won't be successful. So everywhere I worked, it was like it was my business. And owners always gave me that leeway because they could see what I could do and what I could produce. And they didn't have to think about it. And so now I'm doing it for myself. It was what I've been training all my life to do, is to run my own restaurant and try and make money out of it.
Was it different running other people's place than it was running your own? Because for me, I ran a bunch of people's places before I owned my own. And I'll tell you, like, there are a bunch of different differences. But the one that sticks out in my mind are the sleepless nights. I never had sleepless nights running somebody else's place. I never just stayed up night after. Not to say that I wasn't stressed or I wasn't worried about losing my job at some point, but it was always kind of internally motivated. But the weight of the business was different as an owner.
I think I got ownership in my 40s. So that came with a lot of experience, and it had come with a lot of running other businesses for a lot of people. So I was at the top of my game. I always thought that I was 10 years late running my own business. I thought I should have done it at 35, but the opportunities didn't happen. So at 45, it was perfect for me at that time because I was just like, I'm on my game. I know what I'm doing. And once I left the kitchen, I knew how to shut everything off. And the one thing I always knew, no matter how big the problem was, there was always a solution, okay? So you just had to figure out what the solution was. And one of the solutions was not to stay up all night and be sleepless about it, because then you're a wreck the next day. And I'm not saying I didn't have sleepless nights, but I didn't have as many as if I was 10 years younger, because throughout lives, there's peaks and valleys, and you know that the valleys are not as deep as they really are. And the peaks, you know, are going to be followed by a valley. So enjoy it. But around the corner, something's coming. So the restaurant business for me was more or less the same. And also, we opened 2007. 2008 was the economy just crashed. So I just had to roll up my sleeves and be practical about it and just do everything myself instead of having the luxury of having all this fat around me that could take care of things. And I didn't have to do it. I just went to doing it myself. And we just made sure that the things that made us money stayed on. And the things that didn't make us money had to be let go of. And I had to take care of it myself. And then with that, we were able to survive the crash of 2008. And we went on to, the restaurant stayed open until 2018.
Let's talk about the cuisine, just because it's going to be a cathartic exercise for me, selfishly. So I owned Prue and Proper in downtown Los Angeles, elevated Southern cuisine. So a lot of overlap between what you guys were doing there and what we were doing as well. And it's hard. It's hard when the type of cuisine you serve represents something very specific within the culture. It's also hard when people walk in and you're serving shrimp and grits and they're like, I can get this back home for $13. And you're like, well, I mean, the plane ticket's going to be expensive. So the meal might be cheap, but it's going to cost a lot of money to get out there.
Well, since well on top of that, I had a British accent. So it was like, what right. Do you know about soul food?
But it's difficult. It's difficult when it's a new interpretation of something that they are very familiar with. And there's also this sense of ownership. I am not a chef, but you know, I worked closely with a chef that was Southern, just like me. And this was our love letter to the South and everything that we had grown up with. Having said that, food, especially soul food, is very tied to culture. And I don't know if in Mexican restaurants, people are kicking open the kitchen door to say, this isn't how you make a torta. I'm going to show you how to make a torta. But in a Southern house, people will tell you what's up. They will. People used to come to me all the time and say, you know, my grandmother makes better gumbo. And I'm like, well, get her on the line. Let's see if she can push through 250 covers tonight.
Exactly. Those are interesting conversations. So I had developed a following in San Francisco. I'd been here since 88. So I had worked 231 Ellsworth. I had worked at Hilton. I worked at the Carnegie Room. I was the black chef in the city. Everybody knew about me and they all followed me. So I had earned my stripes, so to speak. You know, I had trained in top fine dining French cuisine. I had done this Californian cuisine, Californian French, farm to table. I had moved seamlessly through all these cuisines and produced it for everybody. And so soul food, What is soul food? I think all cuisine has their own soul food. I'm of a Caribbean ancestry. So there's nothing much more soulful than Caribbean food. It's the same thing. And when my wife started cooking stuff for me and what she called soul food, I was like, oh, I recognize this. Greens, colored greens and all that. We have the same thing. The gumbo, we have a soup that we did. It was very similar to that. So there's so much similarities to what I grew up in. Even though I grew up in England, I didn't grow up with baked beans on toast, even though I had it. But I grew up in a Caribbean house, a Jamaican house, that did soul food, our version of it. But it was the same ingredients. We all came from Africa bringing the same ingredients to the West Indies, to South of America. And we used the same peppers. We used the same peanuts, okra. We used all the same things. So it was not that difficult for me to make that leap. It wasn't that big of a leap. Also, when my wife was doing it, I would take it and I was like, oh, yeah, let me do something with it. Now I'm bringing all my training laid to bear from the Roux brothers and being in here in California, and I'm making it look good. And I just remembered I was invited to James Beard House a few years before I opened the restaurant for Black History Month. And the chef goes, oh, yeah, you're going to come and do soul food with us. And even at that point, I said, what do I know about soul food? And I'm like, David, it's a free plane ticket, free airport. Just show up. I go, yeah, you're right. And I remember I took this dish and I got cornbread. And I did an apple compote. And then I did foie gras on top of it, sauteed foie gras. And then I made the huckleberry gastric sauce. So I had the sweetness there on that. And then I did an apple chip that I put on top of that that was nice and crispy. And then I took some of the foie gras oil and sprayed it around that. So, you know, you had that yellow foie gras oil going around there. And then you have the huckleberry going for it. And we had to go up and put our dishes and describe our dishes. And if you see soul food, it tastes good, but not many people know how to make it look good. And so when I put my dish up there, everybody's like, wow, that looks really good. And I'm like, yeah, it does, doesn't it? And compared to all the other dishes, which really taste good, but none of them had had a 3-star Michelin training. It was unfortunate. Well, it was fortunate for me that I was able to do that. And then they turned around. Someone said to me, one of the guys there said to me, hey, we could do something with you in New York. And I said, no, I want to go back to California and do this. So then I started looking for a place to do this. And so when I was looking around, I was looking for spots. And then this 1300 project came up. So it was very easy for me to move into.
So let's talk about Good Night specifically. So what was the path that led you there?
I was actually doing a TV show in New York. We're doing this steakhouse in Hillsborough. And I go, a steakhouse? Oh, it's just so funny. 2 weeks before, I had gone back to England to celebrate my birthday. And while I'm over there, I started talking to some friends of mine who were from the Bay Area, American couple who had gone back there. And they're working for this hotel group over there. And they'd taken me to a steakhouse. It was their 35th wedding anniversary. And they took me to a steakhouse. And I was like, I don't want to come to your wedding anniversary. They said, we've had so many of these. Don't worry about it. Come over. We like it. We love you. So they took me to the steakhouse, and it was a steakhouse called Cut with Wolfgang Puck restaurant. I just was like, wow, this is a great steakhouse. I haven't been in a steakhouse I hadn't really thought about a steakhouse since I was 16 years old. I could do this again. Lo and behold, I come back to America, finish doing the TV show, and I get a phone call about the steakhouse up in Hillsborough. And it basically said, hey, we know that you're up in a wine country where there's a steakhouse opening. We think you would be just great for this. Would you be interested? I said, I would be very much interested. But I'm in New York. I'm doing the job there. I won't be back for about 3-4 weeks. And I will come and talk to you after that. They said, yeah, we'll wait for you. And that's how this came about.
So how long have you been at the Good Night?
So I've been there since the opening. I created the menu for it.
Yep.
I got involved in there in April. And we opened in August. And I've been there since the start. And it's been fun. It's had its challenges. Wine country restaurant, finding people to work. The winter months are dead, trying to understand that. But at my age now, I've become more of a teacher to my staff. I enjoy the Hillsborough people. They have been open arms to me and welcomed me with open arms. And I walk around town and everybody recognizes, hey, chef, how you doing? And I love that part. with my staff, it's been very challenging. I've just, in my mind, I've said, okay, David, just teach, and you're good at teaching, and accept what you have now, because it's completely different from back in my day. Back in my day, I sound like my dad now, but you just said, we chef, you know, how high. Now you have to explain what you do and reinforce it and make sure that you bring people along with you, which is, I think, is healthier for them. I don't know so much for myself at times, but in the long run, it's healthier for me. And I'm having fun. I just really enjoy it. I work many, many days there and don't even realize the time just goes. So when you're doing something you love to do, it's not like work. And I really enjoy this. I love making new concepts. I love making new restaurants and building them up and leaving my imprint on them and my style on there. With that restaurant, with a steakhouse, every restaurant I've gone, I've kind of left something of David in there. So what I've done there is I've introduced sauces where you have choices of sauces, like a béarnaise, a green peppercorn, Armagnac sauce, Bordelaise sauce. You don't see sauces like that made anymore. People don't do that anymore. I brought salts on where you can choose what salt you want on your steak. We have a smoked salt. We have a truffle salt. We have a pink salt. We have a Hawaiian black sea salt. The steaks are nice and thick and juicy, and we sear them off. And then we season, but you can add a little bit more salt and add a little bit more of your own style. So what we do is we kind of make you part of the experience and allow you to add to the experience and make the dish somewhat unique to how you want it, with incorporating those things. So those are the things I brought to Good Nights, and I've really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed that experience, and people seem to be enjoying what we do.
Did the pandemic change the way you view your career or success?
It has changed restaurants. I think we lost a bunch of seasoned professionals who went elsewhere and decided to get out of the business. And so now we have professionals who are now young to the career and they're learning. So when I say I become more of a teacher, I've had to because they don't have as much experience. So it's like having a young football team. You've got to gather them around and teach them. And there's going to be bumps on the road, but they're going to learn through experience. And experience takes time, as you know. And so bring them along and make them realize what it takes to run a good restaurant. But saying that, a lot of our clientele understand it and they see it and they kind of allow us to make those mistakes. Whereas before, they were a lot more critical.
For those that don't know, what is the Conversation Project?
Oh, the Conversation Project was something that myself and Mark Spears kind of put together during the pandemic, just him being at my house on the deck, drinking and eating. And we just wanted to talk about the Black experience in food and wine. And being in this environment, there weren't many of us and people like ourselves who were normal Black folks in America that sometimes don't get seen, don't get heard. And so the Conversation Project developed from food and wine to a conversation that is held at everybody's table. I don't care what color you are or where you come from, what religion, whatever. But when you sit down, you break bread and drink wine and you have conversations about life, about the country, about people. And that's what it was about. We wanted to show regular African Americans who are doing good and that you don't normally see. They don't promote that. They promote the athlete. They promote the bad guy. They don't promote the in-between, the normal people, the Cosbys, so to speak. Although I don't know how good a name it is to use at the moment. But you know what I mean. You know,
I do know what you mean. Absolutely, yeah. I know what you mean. And so a life that you could aspire to, a good life.
Yeah, it's one that I've worked to get to, and I'm enjoying. And there's many people around me who are just like me who are doing the same thing, but you never hear. We never have a voice. We never have a conversation about what we're doing at the table. And I think that the Conversation Project allowed us to do that.
And what are the ripples of that? I mean, you mentioned the fact that your role now is as a teacher, and Lord knows you can work in a restaurant and you can serve your community, but you're also working to serve the industry on a larger level. How do you see conversations like that evolving in the industry at large, but also like in your role?
Well, I see conversations like that in America are very important because when I first got here, everybody seems to keep to their own area. And I was like, well, do you go to their house and have a meal? And like, no, but you work together. Yeah, but we all leave and go home separate ways. And I grew up in England where we were in each other's house, eating each other's food, listening to each other's music, and just having an understanding. And I'm not saying England was perfect. We had our own problems over there, but our problem was a lot shorter and it wasn't as in-depth and it doesn't have the history that America has. But I think that a show like that and people like ourselves can break down the stereotypes and make people realize that we're all the same people. We all have the same problems. We're all having the same conversations, and it's just, but just from a different viewpoint. And I think that's very much needs to happen over here. And I believe it is happening. I've been here 36 years and I'm not born here. And I see the transition of this country. And then although people are like, oh, well, you know, it's more racist than it's ever been. I think it's more exposed than it's ever been. And I think for you to grow, you have to expose it. And that's what's happening now. Whereas before it was just swept under the carpet. Now it's being exposed. Now it's being talked about. And with that conversation, things change. And we're going through that period of change. And change is always difficult. So I like to be a part of that change. And I want to be a change maker. I think I have been all my life. And I think change is good.
Let's continue. Let's pull on that string a little bit more. Our industry is full of unspoken rules and traditions about how things should be done. How would you like to see the restaurant industry turn the tables to create a better future for all of us?
Well, I see that happening now. I just remembered when I first came here, we didn't see people of color in the front of restaurants. I never saw that. I would not see people of color in a restaurant. And I'm talking about liberal West Coast. It always amazed me. And I looked at it, I went, okay. I made a mental note of it, but I didn't say anything or do anything about it because I wasn't in a position to do that. Now I see, because of the need, that has completely changed. I'm in Hillsburg. I go to a bank and it's the bank manager Latino. The tellers are Latino. Everybody in the bank is Latino. 36 years ago, that would never have happened. That's a good change. And that's become normal. And once things are normalized like that, and then people accept it. And I think those things are happening. Even though people don't think they're happening quickly enough, I feel they are. And they can never be quickly enough. But I think considering the history of mankind, we're in a time period where things are evolving so quickly. And they are changing before our very eyes. I'd love to come back 400 years from now and just see the changes that are here. They're going to be tremendous. I'm so hopeful. For mankind, I think we're on the right trajectory, and don't let little hiccups like what's happened, as happening, to take us off the course where we're going. This train is going. It's moving. It's not going to change. Our kids are all mixing. They're all talking. They're all going to school together. They're all seeing things differently. You think my son's generation worries about things like that? No, they just move on. And that things are changing. I just think it's us older folks who are hung up on stuff. And we won't be along that long. So things are changing. And in the industry, within the culinary industry, things are changing. Restaurants are changing. I just see a more diverse culinary employment all around wherever I go. I think for a period of time, African-Americans didn't aspire to be in restaurants. They didn't want to be part of service because there's somewhat of stigma towards it because of the history of being in service in this country. And now I feel I see more and more African-Americans in the industry, and I warm to that. I go and say hello, and I kind of give them a little bit of history of what I've done, and if they allow me to, if they want to hear it. Sometimes they don't. But I have to figure out when I get in front of them and start talking to them and tell them that, yeah, there are more of us out there, and that is a change, and it's a good thing.
Our industry suffers from razor-thin margins, and the only way for us to ensure profitability is to make data-driven decisions. The numbers don't lie, and Yelp for Restaurants just released some incredibly compelling numbers. For starters, Yelp reaches 9 times more customers online than OpenTable. And when restaurants pair that level of visibility with Guest Manager and Yelp ads, they experience up to an 8% lift in diner bookings. Think about what that 8% lift could do for your restaurant's finances. To learn more about how Yelp for Restaurants can support your business, visit restaurants.yelp.com/full comp to learn more today. That's Chef David Lawrence. For more on Good Nights, visit goodnightsrestaurant.com. If you want to tell us your story, hear previous episodes, or check out our other content, go to restaurants.yelp.com/full comp. Thank you so much for listening to the show. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. While you're there, please leave us a review. A special thanks to Yelp for helping us spread the word to the whole hospitality community. I'm Josh Kopel. You've been listening to Full Comp.